we don't know what the price of oil is going to be next year. And so it's literally a game show that we're playing.
On the road with the traveling show on Alaska's massive budget problem. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 8th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, another year of low numbers for wolves in Denali National Park.
This year, only 5% of the 530,000 visitors to the park were able to see wolves.
Those stories tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Governor Bill Walker will unveil his budget tomorrow, and the backdrop isn't pretty. If the price of oil remains low, Alaska could face a budget deficit of $3.1 billion. In an effort to get Alaskans on the same page, State Budget Director Pat Pitney has spent the past 6 months leading fiscal dialogues in communities throughout Alaska. And last week, she brought her talking points to Sitka along with a wooden scale to simulate the state budget crisis. KCAW's Emily Kwonk has more.
We live on risk in Alaska.
Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins is playing Pat Sajak. He's standing before a spinning wheel, which represents the price of oil.
Because we don't know what the price of oil is going to be next year. And so it's literally a game show that we're playing.
Lately, the price of oil has been at $40 a barrel, which leaves the state with a $3.1 billion gap between revenue and spending. It's a problem so big, you have to see it to believe it. Christ Tompkins then hands the microphone over to State Budget Director Pat Pitney, who has been traveling around Alaska to lay out with a wooden scale what exactly is broken about the budget.
We are almost entirely dependent on oil price and production for our budget. And at $40 a barrel oil, that is what creates that budget gap.
Pitney then transitions to the wooden scale in front of her, inviting Sitkins to literally balance the books. Christ Tompkins joins her in explaining how it works. I know this is radio, but just picture this with me. It's a wooden scale. Loaded on either side are blocks of different colors.
So each of these blocks is $100 million.
Basically, each block represents life as we know it in Alaska. On the left side is how much money the state currently spends, $5.1 billion in total.
This is spending.
And on the right side,
this is revenue. They have to balance.
The scale is balanced for this year, but there's a catch.
Our current budget is balanced on the back of our savings.
Represented as a pile of white blocks. These were taken from Alaska's Constitutional Budget Reserve, or rainy day account. It's pretty big, $7 billion, but won't last, Pitney explains, if the state continues to drain it to keep the budget balanced.
So if we do nothing, this savings is gone in 2 years. Then the next choice is to go to this savings pile, which is the earnings reserve.
AKA the money that can be spent from the permanent fund. PFD checks come from here. The blocks are gold with a white dot on them. But if Alaska drains all that too,
the dividends will stop.
And that is a future Pitney doesn't want to come to pass.
We don't like that picture at all. We want to do something sustainable now.
She couldn't go into detail about Governor Bill Walker's budget, but her presentation did provide a glimpse of how the administration wants to close the gap in the long run. They're looking at the power of the permanent fund, which at $51 billion is so big, it earns more money on interest than the state deposits in revenue. The return on investment follows the stock market, which in general has a more consistent performance than the price of oil.
Over the life of the permanent fund, it's earned almost 10%, 9.7% annually. So yes, you could have a 2008, and it could be, you know, bad for a period of time. But on average, over time, this is the better investment model.
Pitney tentatively calls the strategy the sovereign wealth model. And it depends on this. If the state can agree to funnel all new resource revenue, from oil royalties to petroleum production taxes, into the permanent fund, it can become a renewable pool of money to run the state. PFD checks would continue but be cut at smaller amounts. Extra bonus if the state can create new taxes. It's well and good to simulate this in the game, but Pitney has learned in her travels that not all communities are comfortable with the same solutions. Southeast seems to not mind a smaller PFD check, but she's found in the North Slope,
they're fine with an income tax, but the idea that the dividend may be less is harder to handle because they're more dependent on it.
And even within these communities, people disagree. A few days later, at the Backdoor Cafe, Blossom Twitchell tussles with the imbalance herself. The game is set up in the middle of the lunch rush. She imposes an income tax, but takes a deep breath before plopping the blocks on the scale.
So this is new territory for me, and as a mother and an Alaskan, I'd rather look into trying to get revenue somewhere.
And just by comparison, taxes on alcohol and marijuana are tiny blocks. They barely tip the scale. And that's really what the game, designed by Gunnar Knapp and Ian Lang of Anchorage, is all about. Weighing what you think you know about the budget against the working reality. By bringing the scale to the people, voters can begin to understand the magnitude of the hard times ahead. Annika Ord of the Island Institute is overseeing the gameplay.
I asked a few people if they wanted to balance the budget, and they're like, well, that sounds depressing. It's like, yeah, it kind of is. But it's the reality.
A reality that will soon be in the hands of the legislature when they meet for regular session in January and hold something far more precious than blocks in their hands. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
University of Alaska Fairbanks officials rolled out statistics on Friday outlining expected funding shortfalls. As KOAC's Robert Hannon reports, administrators say rising costs and cuts in state dollars have produced a $42 million gap.
Interim UAF Chancellor Mike Powers and other administrators project a troubled fiscal landscape for the school in 2017. 40% of the university's budget is tied to state dollars, which are growing scarcer as lawmakers grapple with low oil prices and deficits. On Friday, Vice Chancellor Kari Burrell outlined the history of UAF funding and the situation today.
The pullbacks that we've had centrally was for $29 million over the last 3 years, but we've also asked units to absorb $13 million. So the total gap that we have filled over the last 3 years has been $42 million.
Burrell talked about vertical and horizontal cuts. Horizontal cuts distribute pain across most programs and has been the prevailing strategy. Now, however, UA President Jim Johnson has asked chancellors to look at vertical cuts, a strategy that could lead to programs with low student numbers to be eliminated or combined with other disciplines. Chancellor Power says most likely both strategies will be employed.
Emphasize the vertical as opposed to the horizontal, but it will be a part of both. Everybody will be touched in some way. There's no question.
Powers underscores the projections are preliminary. He says university officials will wait to see what Governor Walker proposes in his budget due out this month, then see what lawmakers come up with when they meet next year. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
In Anchorage today, State House and Senate Judiciary Committee members listened to recommendations from the authors of a Department of Corrections administrative review. The independent review, released in November, was conducted at the request of Governor Bill Walker and focuses on the failure of some state prison policies. A spate of prisoner deaths within Alaska prisons over the past 2 years spurred the review. Dean Williams, a special assistant to the governor and one of the review authors, said some DOC policies have not been revised since the 1980s.
Certainly by what we've found, there's a public trust issue here. So we have a ways to go on this.
Williams said failures of prison policies are system-wide and range from lack of training or no training at all for corrections officers to the widespread disparity in interpretation of Title 47 alcohol statutes, which define the parameters for incarceration for alcohol abuse. Williams' testimony focused on four cases of inmate deaths, which could have been avoided had prison staff been better trained. About 2 years ago, Dave John Mosley, a young man who was not charged with a crime but was taken into protective custody on a welfare check, died in a solitary cell after going days without needed medication. Through a series of graphic photos taken from prison video, Williams shows the physical deterioration of Mosley, who died of internal bleeding without medical attention. Senator Liesl McGuire, who chaired the hearing, said the legislature will consider an omnibus bill addressing judicial reform, including a comprehensive look at Title 47. She said many people now incarcerated in Alaska prisons have mental health issues.
It's been an evolution. It didn't happen overnight. My belief is that it's a combination of factors, but certainly the cuts to the community health system have left the mentally ill of Alaska without a home, without a place. At least two of these cases were those who were either had the disease of alcoholism or had a mental illness, and in both cases, neither had been charged with a crime.
McGuire says at this time there is no indication of a criminal investigation.
I haven't seen anything that I have looked at that to me shows an intentional murder. What I think you have is a systematic breakdown. You have lack of training. You have the timing of the training versus when that individual is being asked to take the job. Rules and policies that are arguably not being followed in the best interest of safety.
She says Devon Mosley's fiancé and father of his three children has requested the legislative package to be named Devon's Law. Tlingit elders help create a curriculum that tells the story of boarding school experiences.
We're helping to write down the story of how boarding schools are affecting us and our families.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wants to keep you safe from the invisible killer. Be safe this winter and always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This is a message from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wishing you a safe and happy holiday season. For more information, visit cpsc.gov. This message sponsored by AHFC.
The Environmental Protection Agency has fined the Army nearly $60,000 for failing to notify the agency of a munitions dump on Fort Wainwright. The base near Fairbanks has been an EPA Superfund site since 1990. According to an EPA statement today, the Army discovered an old munitions and explosives dump at the fort's small arms firing range in June of 2013, with lead and other heavy metals eroding into the Tananaw River. The Army was supposed to notify the EPA within 15 days, but the EPA says it only learned of the dump more than a year later in a memo from an Army contractor. A partial cleanup this year produced more than 160 tons of material, including explosives and unfired rounds. A fall count of Denali National Park wolves indicates a slight rebound of the predator's depressed population in the park. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the overall population remains near a 30-year low, and fewer visitors report seeing the animals.
62 wolves were counted in Denali National Park this fall, a tally up from last spring's 52, a change park biologist Bridget Borg says reflects positive and negative trends among Denali's 11 wolf packs.
It seems like we've had some packs that have shown better recruitment, meaning that they had more pups that survived until the fall this year. But then we've had some larger packs, like, say, the East Fork pack, that has decreased in size.
Borg says the long-studied and once popularly viewed East Fork pack did not appear to den this year, contributing to its continued decline. She notes some increase in wolf sightings along the first portion of the park road.
Because there was a pack there that had five pups and was denning not far from the park road. But further along the park road, or most of our visitors travel. We didn't see really a change this year, although some of that has to do with where the packs are denning.
Denali's overall wolf population remains far below a 2007 peak of 147 animals, and wolf protection advocate Rick Steiner says that's reflected in fewer park visitors seeing the iconic predators.
The visitor viewing success rate actually declined further this year. Over 2014, it went down another percent. So this year, only 5% of the 530,000 visitors to the park were able to see wolves.
Steiner partially blames the decline on the Board of Games' 2010 elimination of a wolf buffer zone. The area of state land along the park's northeast boundary aimed to limit the annual public harvest of several Denali wolves as they roam outside the park. Steiner is pushing for a new, larger protective area, but Park Resources team leader Dave Schierkauer contends it wouldn't solve the broader Denali wolf decline.
Harvest levels might impact particular packs and may influence viewing opportunities, but for the population as a whole, other things are probably bigger drivers.
Schierkauer says those include moose and caribou numbers and their locations, and wolves' ability to take down the animals, which is tougher in low snow cover years. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The state is using a new application process to select recipients of big game killed on southern Kenai Peninsula roads, as well as fish or game confiscated by authorities. KBBI's Quentin Chandler reports the changes are supposed to improve the fairness and efficiency of the roadkill program.
Getting the call to come pick freshly killed game up from the side of the road is like winning the lottery in some parts of Alaska, and dozens of Kenai Peninsula residents wait for their turn year after year. The lucky winners usually can expect an adult or immature moose, on occasion a bear, and sometimes confiscated fish or game. Casey Moss from the Alaska State Troopers Anchor Point Post says in the past, the roadkill program has been criticized for being unfair.
We get a lot of frustration from people saying, well, you know, so-and-so has gotten moose after moose after moose, and I haven't gotten any.
Until recently, applications to receive roadkills went through the Homer Police Department. Moss says the department tried not to give the same people back-to-back calls, and they tried to give animals on a first-come, first-served basis. But the department only called people living within so many miles of a carcass.
You have some areas, say like Blackwater Bend, where, you know, it seems like you get lots of moose hit in that area, or, you know, certain areas along the highway. And so people that were in that response area tended to be called more frequently.
Now the troopers are going to give Homer PD a break by taking on the bulk of the Southern Peninsula's calls. Homer Police will only be responsible for road kills within Homer city limits. The change means people who already applied through Homer PD for roadkills have to put in a new application with the troopers.
Their application is in the book until, or on the list, I suppose, until they receive a moose. And then in that year, they are not eligible to receive another moose. They have to reapply in January of the next year.
Moss says the troopers are changing how they decide who is called next. Now where you live is less important than how quickly you can get to an animal.
Now we've kind of simplified it down to basically East End Road, Homer, Anchor Point, Happy Valley, Nanilchik, or Clam Gulch. As long as they can respond to one of those areas within 30 minutes, they've got 30 minutes to respond to that area to receive the moose or the game, whatever it happens to be.
Moss says anyone who wants to be considered to receive future roadkills can pick up applications at the Homer Department of Fish and Game Office, the Homer Police Department, and the Anchor Point State Trooper Post. So far, about 51 people have applied. In Homer, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
34% of Alaskans volunteer with organizations. That's the eighth highest rate in the United States, according to the Corporation for National and Community Service. The number one contribution by Alaskans is providing transportation for seniors and others who have difficulty getting around. The organization's CEO, Wendy Spencer, says many things influence whether or not people choose to volunteer.
Education rights, home ownership rights, poverty rights, the density of nonprofits. So maybe you would see more volunteering in Anchorage as opposed to a smaller community because you have more faith organizations and nonprofits to volunteer through.
The rankings don't take into account the 62% of Alaskans that say they volunteer informally just by helping their neighbors. Spencer says all in all, the data shows Alaskans are doing pretty well.
And it shows that you really do reach out and help your neighbors, and you care a lot about the community in Alaska. And it's not only a beautiful physical place to visit, but it's also a kind place.
Utah ranked first for all volunteer rates for every age other than teenagers. Most people there contributed time to religious organizations. You can see more data at alaskapublic.org. Code Haines, Skagway, and Juneau run their own Lynn Canal Ferry Authority. With budget cuts and reduced service to the Alaska Marine Highway, leaders from Skagway and Haines are considering that idea. KHNS's Emily Files reports.
The Ferry Authority is just an idea right now, but Schaefer and Hill say it's time to take it seriously.
All we're looking at is more cuts and boats being laid up.
We're concerned. We need our ferries.
The Alaska Marine Highway is facing deep budget cuts from the state. In the proposed schedule for next summer, the Marine Highway would tie up two fast ferries and the Malaspina and Taku, slashing the number of port calls throughout coastal communities. Bart Henderson is a Haines resident who was part of a group that explored the idea of the local ferry authority about 15 years ago.
Looking at next year's schedule and how bleak it looks, it's just obvious to everybody that there needs to be some major changes made in the ferry system some way, somehow. I think all options, as they should be, are on the table.
Henderson, the Haines and Skagway mayors, and Skagway resident Jan Rentmore met with ferry system chief Newsel. Here he is.
The economic times that the state finds themselves in and the marine highway system finds ourselves in make it prone that looking at something like this might make sense now, and it deserves a look and an analysis.
Newsel says it's too soon to say whether the state would be supportive of the ferry authority. But he says if it provides more efficient transportation for Alaskans, he would be for it. Henderson thinks it has great potential to be more efficient.
A ferry authority would have the ability to start from scratch and design its schedule and its routes and its times and its capacities around the actual demand of when people want to travel.
Henderson says the Alaska Marine Highway is burdened with high costs from large vessels that run at less than full capacity in the winter. He thinks a Lynn Canal Ferry Authority could have smaller vessels that run multiple departures during the summer and then pare down service in the winter as demand drops. Skagway Mayor Schaefer says the next step is to commission a feasibility study. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
By talking about boarding school experiences, Tlingit elders in Juneau are turning painful memories into sources of healing for themselves and generations still living with the consequences. As KTOO's Lisa Fu reports, a local Native corporation is using those stories to create a curriculum that will focus on the impacts on the Tlingit people.
Before telling her story, Della Cheney from Cake sings a spirit song for all the families who were part of the boarding school era. Cheney is on a panel of 13 Tlingit elders during the recent clan conference in Juneau. Since August, they've been meeting once a month with other elders at Gold Belt Heritage Foundation.
We're helping to write down the story of how boarding schools are affecting us and our families today. so that our children and grandchildren will know the history and realize the changes our families, our people faced.
From the late 1800s to the mid-1900s, the federal government split families and forced Native children into boarding schools to assimilate. Cheney says many were also raised in orphanages.
That time is still walking with us today. The people who were raised with no love or affection in a very hostile environment also raised their children without much nurturing or affection. So today, we see some of our families suffering from abuse.
Cheney says both her parents attended Sheldon Jackson School in Sitka. Her mother was only 10 when she was brought there in 1923.
It just breaks my heart to think that I was raised in such a loving family, to know that my mother and father weren't.
But Cheney says those who went to boarding schools persevered. In Cake, they fought to make the village a first-class city in 1951, allowing the community to operate its own school system. Emma Shorty is from Tesling, Yukon. She was 4 when she was taken away from her family in 1937 to go to a residential school in Carcross.
We were never allowed to go anywhere. We had to stay in the one yard. They put a fence around the school. They used to lock the fence. And when we went to bed, they would lock our doors. And there was no bathrooms to go to. So we got into trouble for wetting our beds.
Shorty says she was molested at the school.
I learned to forgive. I wasn't always kind. Residential school just about killed my spirit. Today, I've forgiven.
Shorty fought hard to have her first daughter go to public school, even though she was turned away again and again for being Tlingit. John Martin went to boarding school in Eklutna and then to the St. Pius X Mission in Skagway.
But instead of Christianity, there were some ugly things that went on, and I'm not going to speak about that.
Martin says many of the elders are still hurt.
By putting us in boarding schools, it was a form of prison. They disrupted our learning process of the language. They actually took a way of life from us when our elders were teaching us how to gather food.
Martin says telling the stories from that time and identifying the hurt is the beginning of healing. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Emily Kwonk in Sitka, Robert Hannon and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Quentin Chandler in Homer, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Emily Files in Haines, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web editor. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Rural CAP commemorates 50 years of delivering early childhood education programs like Head Start and Parents as Teachers. Signature housing programs, including weatherization, self-help housing, and permanent affordable housing, make a difference in our communities. AmeriCorps members and elder mentors have positive impacts to education, health, and the environment. Learn more at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience. Through their engaging staff and faculty, APU's education is designed to broaden and deepen their students' potential through action and understanding. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.